This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
It is a huge honor and privilege to have with us friend, colleague,
it's an explosive
Dr. Alec Isaacs. We started off the week with also a colleague and friend of both of ours, Professor Jay Rothman, who kind of did a little bit of framing about identity conflict in general. Yesterday, we went into a particular application of how do you engage in identity conflict by learning about the example of Kids for Peace, which is really dealing with the interfaith and what we call, what Jay referred to as track three diplomacy. How do you get civil society involved in meeting each other, in exploring their own identity, the identity of the others? Today, we are really excited to have Dr. Alec Isaacs, who is the leader in what I would call intra-faith, okay, in terms especially what we refer to here as track two diplomacy. It's not, I see it though, because you're dealing with, the way Jay defined track two, right, it's people that are not so far away from what's going on in society, in the communities, they're connected, they're leaders of communities, they're not just, you know, heads of state, but they are also not more than one or two phone calls removed from the people that make decisions in the Knesset, in the government, and those are the people that you can try to engage. So I don't want to say too much about what you're going to talk about, but he runs a runs an amazing organization that is extremely modest, called Siach Shalom, okay? A play on words of not peace talks, but talking about peace, but not peace, but shalom, which I assume you'll share what that means. He's also an academic, a philosopher, a writer, and a practitioner, another great example of how you could be deeply, deeply thinking about
I think we have to shut you up before
and changing the world at the same time. Oh, so, yes. So excited to have you.
Ridiculous introduction.
But
thank you.
You can go on for that.
It was way out of proportion. Mitav on, everybody. Enjoy your lunch.
Thank you.
Feel free to chomp away, and don't try looking at me when you're eating. Look at your food. It's fine. I won't be offended. You don't need to worry about eye contact while you're eating, because I don't want you to spill it. My name is Alec Isaacs, and yes, I'm one of the co-directors of a small organization called Siach Shalom. You were here last year, I remember you from last year, I know you. And I'm apologizing before I start, I've got a little bit of a cough, so if I break off into bouts of coffee, please forgive me. I'm not infectious, I think I've got allergies or something, so please forgive that. What I would like to do, Daniel sent me a text message this morning, and in his text message it said, please leave plenty of time for questions.
Yes.
So we've got about 40 minutes or so. I can easily talk about Siach Shalom for 2 or 3 hours without breathing. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try and keep it very brief. I'll do my best. I don't promise. It's very difficult. But I'll try and be fairly brief. Explain to you, just tell you a little bit about who I am, a little bit about my background. I'll tell you about the ideas behind Siach Shalom. I'll try and share with you, I'll give you a taste of some of the practical side of our work, what we have done over the years, and what challenges we're facing right now. And hopefully, if I can squeeze all that into 20 minutes, there'll be 20 minutes for questions and discussion. I don't promise, but I will try. I really don't promise, because I'm terrible at this, but I will try. I will try. Let me say a little bit about myself. As you can hear by now, I have a weird accent. And the reason I have a weird accent is because I moved around a little bit in my childhood. I was born in Glasgow in Scotland. I lived in Scotland until I was about 6 years old, and my family moved to a godforsaken city called Birmingham in the middle of England, which was really, really a wonderful place to live. Are you from Birmingham?
Yeah.
Who's from Birmingham?
From Manchester.
Where are you from?
Paris.
That's basically the same as Zurich, right? That's ridiculous. If you think about the football team. Anyway, Mancunians and Brummies have got very little in common. We can hardly understand each other. I'm sure you can't understand a word that he says anyway.
Shut up.
Now, the The story. I'm going to say just a little bit about my aliyah, this is a long story, and we don't have time. But I was the victim of a really, really horrible anti-Semitic attack when I was 14 years old. I was really, really badly beaten up in Britain. I was wearing my kippah and walking in the street. I decided I was going to learn chavrut. I was learning Gemara with a local rabbi, and I was walking in the street on the way home from my little chavrut with him. We were doing the first parak of Masechet Brachot. No, we weren't. We were doing the last parak of Masechet Pesachim. We were doing our big Pesachim, and I was on my way home, and I got spotted by a bunch of skinhead National Front teenagers who were bigger than I am. I think they were bigger than I am now, but they were certainly a lot bigger than I was then. And I was really, really bad, very badly attacked. And I think, although I wouldn't say that that's the reason I came on Aliyah, I've been very, very involved in Jewish life. I came from a religious family, a Bnei Akiva family. I've been very involved in the youth movement. But, you know, it was a big part of my life, the plan to come on Aliyah. I think that the decision to come on Aliyah was very, it was like the soundtrack that accompanied the decision was this event that had a very powerful and formative impact on me. And maybe in some ways it limited my vision of what Zionism was all about. And thank God since then I've developed a richer and more nuanced sense of it. But maybe there's some historical truth about this whole business of getting away from that was quite powerful. It was Thatcher's Britain. You weren't born. It was Thatcher's Britain. The streets were violent. These were tough times. And the desire to get out and to come to Jewish space was very, very, very powerful. The reason I mention this is because I want to contrast it with what I think was, you know, the other side of the same story from my perspective now, looking back on it, which was my military service, which came 5 years later, which at the time was a lot of life. Between 14 and 19, that was 5 years was a lot of life, but now 5 years is a lot less of life, as you can tell by the color of my hair. I'm about to be a grandfather. Did you know that? I'm on the verge of
being
a grandfather.
Thank you.
So, in 1987, I spent basically December 1987 through till whatever it was, May 1989, fighting the First Intifada. The First Intifada really started. I was like the first target of the First Intifada. It was my unit that encountered it first. And again, without going into the details of this, because our time is limited, the contrasting and ironic experience of kind of leaving Britain to get away from the violence that characterized, you know, the experience of being Jewish on the streets, and then finding yourself under very, very different circumstances. I was weak, I was vulnerable, I was scared, I rolled up in a ball and I was beaten to a pulp when I was 14 years old. When I was 19, I was armed to the teeth, I was carrying a submachine gun that was surrounded by other people who were equally well equipped, and I was extremely well trained, and it was a completely different reality. And I think at the time, the realities were so different from each other that I didn't really make the connection. I had there's one story that I don't have time to tell, where I had a glimpse of it and where I kind of felt it. But I was powerfully struck as time went on by the transition of transition between seeing Israel as such a powerful answer to my questions and to my desire for peace, to live peacefully as a Jew in the world. And having that turned on and discovering that here I was facing very, very complex questions, I got very, very concerned and very interested in wanting to engage with, you know, the challenge of how do we make peace in the Middle East. By the way, I don't know the answer to that question. I teach courses about this, and always the first thing I say to my students is, we're going to talk about the conflict in the Middle East. I do not know the solution. I think it's very important to approach this particular conflict with humility. But what struck me during the years that followed my military service was that there was quite a powerful discrepancy between my social identity as a member of the religious community in Israel and my strong desire for peace. peace and being religious were in many ways at odds. I belong to a small bubble in the Israeli political, social scene that I suppose we referred to ourselves at the time as the religious left, Meimad, if you've ever heard of it. It was a very small party that believed that it was the whole world until it discovered that it was really very, very small. And while my Rosh Hashiva was still alive, his name was Rabbi Yehuda Amital, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, an extraordinary and amazing person, who, despite my reservations, joined the Rabin government. I had reservations about Rabin. I had very powerful reservations about Rabin, because in the time when I was in the Intifada, he was the guy who said, Mishbol Emetei Yadayim Beit HaRegleim. And I found that a little bit difficult. Yeah, well, you know, his famous reaction to what are we going to do about the Intifada? Rabin's answer was, we'll break their arms and legs. That's, you know, I was never very excited about that.
That was in the 80s.
Sorry?
That was much earlier.
It was in 1987. But Rav Amital decided that it was possible to try and build a bridge between the people who wanted peace and the majority of the religious community that was... If you think about it, I don't know how to describe this. I think the best way to describe them is that they are the Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kuk. The Bet Midrash, the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kuk. And by the way, it's very, very important when you talk about the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kuk to understand. You know, people always say, well, do you mean the father or the son? Right? And for them, the father and the son are extremely closely connected and consistent. The son translates loyally and consistently the teachings of the father. And the Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kuk were essentially the ones...
Right,
Rav Kuk, Rabbi Kuk, was the first chief rabbi of Israel, died in 1935. Really, the father figure of religious Zionism. A very, very complex and deep mystical thinker, but also a great halachist. You know, really an extraordinary figure in 20th century Jewish thought. His son is often criticized as not having continued his legacy with the same complexity. We've discussed it. It's personally a topic that I find fascinating, but what is relevant is that the people who are the disciples of that camp don't make the distinction. So, because a lot of people see that Rav Tzvi Yehuda can turn right when after 1967, he was the one who said, let's start settling in Yehuda Shomron. It was very, very significant. The move that came from his impetus to start settling in Hebron and to build Kiryat Arba and Elon Moreh, and gradually it spread out and developed. So, bridging the gap between that community that represented the majority of the religious Zionist camp and who you know, we were, was kind of the religious Zionist supporters of the Oslo process, was something that Meimad did not do. And for many years I was frustrated about this issue, angry about this issue, and I kind of left it aside. In 2010, I got together with two colleagues, Avinoam Rosnak, who is also my brother-in-law, I'm married to his little sister, and also I would say one of the great scholars alive today, one of the great scholars of Rav Kook's teaching. He teaches at the Hebrew University in the Jewish Philosophy Department and in the Melton Center for Jewish Education, and he is really, you know, somebody who's developed a powerful insight into what the DNA of Rav Kook's thinking was really all about. And that's a big deal, because Rav Kook is extremely difficult to read and understand. And Avinoam kind of created a very rich template for deciphering what the basic principles of Rav Kook's thinking were. So that's one colleague. The other colleague is Sharon Leshem Zinger, who is really a remarkable woman. She's extremely gifted. And she has she's got years and years and years of experience working with conflict groups as a group dynamic facilitator. She trained as a psychodramatist and as a group dynamic facilitator, but has evolved and developed, I think, over the years into a real philosopher of how to look at conflict situations, from the macro down to what happens in a small group. And her teachings in this area are really quite remarkable. And the three of us got together, and we decided that we wanted to put three principles on the table and to establish an initiative that we hoped would do something to help advance peace in the Middle East. Principle number one. When we started this, people thought we were crazy. We were actually really badly insulted when we started this. But today, I think, thank God, thanks to our work and the work of many others, this principle has become more and more recognized. We argued that the internal conflicts inside both Israeli and Palestinian society, and not just the conflicts between Israelis and Palestinians, were an essential element of the conflict in the Middle East. Now, if you think about it psychologically, when you wake up in the morning and you're feeling, you're not happy about something, right? You're in an internal conflict. So the first thing you do is you wake up and you fight with other people, right? There's a connection between internal disquiet and external conflict, right? That's cheap psychology. But if we expand that socially, the argument was that you can see this inside Israeli society and Palestinian society. And the principle that we put on the table was that in the context of trying to address Israeli-Palestinian relations, which we are interested in, and which we do work on, and we'll get to that, which is why I was a little bit huffy when you said that we just work intra. And we also work with government. We also work a lot with government. We're doing projects now in the Knesset, and we're doing projects with government ministers, and we're doing projects with foreign governments. And so I'm a little bit trapped to... I was kicking on the chair with all of that. But the issue that we decided that we wanted to put on the table was the need to address the internal conflicts. And as far as we were concerned, and this came from my gut, and it came from Avinoah, and it came from Sharon's experience as well, who'd been very involved in trying to create dialogue between the Gush Katif settlers and the rest of Israel in the period leading up to the disengagement in 2005. So we'd all come with baggage in this particular issue, and the question that we wanted to the challenge that we wanted to address. If we're going to deal with internal conflict in Israeli society, the internal conflict that we decided would be most important for us to direct our limited resources to was the conflict between the rabbinic leaders in the ideological settlements. Places like Hebron, Kiryat Arba, Itamar, Yitzhar, Klumin, whatever, you know the list. Would it be possible to bring rabbis and leaders from that community into a conversation with people... on the left in Israel? The left is a very vague term that refers basically to everybody who's prepared to talk about land compromise. Don't take that left with a capital L. It's just left of. Everything's relative. But the issue that we put on the table, which was, I think, the second issue, is not just the internal dialogue, but we understood that we needed to actually talk about peace. People who try to make peace or to resolve conflict are usually talking about the issues that are in the conflict. So I'm upset about this, that, and the next thing. We're gonna argue about the issues. But we decided that we wanted to try and put the emphasis on the concept of peace itself. And I want to give you two illustrations of this, which I think help. The first is semantic. The second is Jewish text-based. Semantically, I think it's interesting to see the distinction between the word peace, which comes from the Latin root pax, which means in English a pact, right, or an agreement, which involves a compromise, right? It's an agreement between two. We disagree, so make an agreement. So you'll give a bit, I'll give a bit, we'll agree. And the Hebrew word shalom, which is rooted in the letter shin lamed mem, which refers to wholeness, completeness. If you like, nothing being broken, nothing being left out. And it's connected to God, by the way. Shalom is one of the names of God. It's connected to Kedusha, connected to holiness. Think about the idea of a Sefer Torah, right? With a piece missing. It's nothing, right? So the idea that you will compromise on something that's sacred isn't peace. You're actually desecrating something. I'll give you an illustration of this that I think is very helpful. There's a Mishnah in Baba Metzia, which I'm sure you all know off by heart, and if you don't, you will. It's one of those texts that gets quoted. Shnayim ochazim betali, ze omer kula sheli, ze omer kula sheli, yachlok. Right? Two people grab onto a scarf like yours, right? And they both pick it up at the same time. We could act it out if we had more time. And one says, it's mine. And the other one says, it's mine. And so, you slice it down. Which makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. But then there's another story, which is actually going to predate the Mishnah. It's the story of Shlomo HaMelech. And when Shlomo HaMelech says, let's divide up the baby, it's not just that the mother said, the outcome is brilliant, but if we just leave the outcome aside for a minute, right, leave the outcome aside. But if you just see the premise of Shlomo's assertion, this is going to work out differently because nobody's going to agree to cut up a baby. That's not going to happen. Right? Because Shnaimu Chazim B'talit, Zel Melkula Shali, Zel Melkula Shali, they both get half a scarf. Right? What's half a scarf? It's actually just a smaller scarf. But half a baby is nothing. Worse than nothing. It's the desecration of something sacred. And when you are in a situation, and here I'm going to use a philosophical term, please forgive me, Thomas Kuhn in The Structures of Scientific Revolutions offers the term of an incommensurability between two paradigms. I'm coughing, just saying.
You have more tea there.
Thank you. Oh, God bless you 1,000 times. When does it have honey in it?
Yes, it does.
Oh, God bless you 2,000 times. When you are dealing with a situation in which two people are looking at the same thing, but from within two fundamentally different worldviews, one of them thinks they're cutting up a scarf and can't figure out why the other one is freaking out.
What?
But the other one is freaking out because what they're seeing is you're cutting up a baby. And people don't understand that difference. And they really don't. Those of you who think of it as a scarf will think I'm crazy talking about it as a baby. You just will. And I'm not going to try and explain to you why it should or can be seen as a baby. I'm not going to go there. Because it just takes too long. It's a real conceptual jump. And those of you who see it as a baby cannot get it when I tell you it's a scarf. What are you talking about? You don't want to slice up. So what we recognize is that people need to have the opportunity to engage with each other in an environment in which they are not going to feel threatened when they encounter an opposing point of view. That was an environment in which they can bring the fullness of their identities, whether their identities are religious and spiritual, and that's the kind of stuff you need to feel comfortable talking about if you want to try and explain why a piece of land is like a baby. Right? You have to create a space where the fullness of what people's identities are all about can be brought into that space. And the flip side, the other side, where other people whose perceptions are completely different and who are secular, and whose perceptions of what peace are fundamentally rooted in the post-Enlightenment theory that we need to secularize the public space so as we can reach agreements over things and get religion out of the way so as we don't have to encounter the intractable convictions that go with religious belief and which make compromise impossible. So, you know, that makes a lot of sense too. It's got a long history. So you've got these two worldviews that need to somehow come in contact with each other in a way that's different from the normal. The normal is you say something, and as you're speaking, what I'm doing is worrying about how I'm going to disprove everything that you've said. Because my whole identity is at stake. Just by listening to you, I've got, you know, I'm screaming on the inside. What happens? How do you facilitate an encounter between people who get the opportunity to really feel understood? And to really give others the opportunity to understand them without necessarily resolving the differences between them or reaching agreements. I think I'm coming right to the end of the time that I have, so I'm going to say very, very quickly that over the last 6 or 7 years, we started this process and we brought together rabbis from Yehuda v'Shomron, and it started off with activists in the peace world in Israel. When I say activists, it ranged at the beginning from public intellectuals to journalists that included former diplomats, military, people of that sort. And as time went on, we were able to expand the scope and the scale of what we were doing. And we got to more and more, we got closer and closer to decision makers. But as we got closer and closer to decision makers, we also started to broaden our focus. And we have been in the last couple of years doing a lot of processes with foreign governments, both ambassadors and foreign ministers from other countries who come here and participate in these kinds of meetings, We've done a lot of work with ambassadors engaging with rabbis. And we've also started doing some really, really interesting work with Palestinians. And I want to tell you one story about that, because it's a good story, but it's also, I think, it's got a little bit of a funny element to it, so it's kind of nice to put that in as well. But what we've seen, I'll just say before I tell the story, is that we've been able not only to broaden the scope, we've been able to make a much, much more public space for people who are religious actors in the context of the conflict to feel that there's an environment in which they can really, become peacemakers. And we've seen these transformations. And at the same time, a lot of people on the other side of the political spectrum have recognized that they have to address these communities because they are significant obstacles when they define their walls as the obstacles to peace. Believe me, they do it very well indeed. So if you want them to not be obstacles for peace, I'll put it the other way around. If you want to make peace, you have to want them to not be obstacles. Their role is extremely, extremely significant. So we've created those spaces, and I think we've managed to get to the level where they're doing more than just exchanging with each other, but they've actually started taking decisions together. And we've had some really breakthrough decisions that these groups have started making together. We did a group last year that made such significant decisions about what it would look like for the left and the right to come up with a peace proposal that they could both work on together. That we're now, the members of the group said, we're going to bring Chavrei Knesset in and let's see if we can do it. We've got a group of Chavrei Knesset from Vita Yudit Meretz that are doing this as well. So it's really getting more closer and closer to creating political outcomes. And you know, we're very excited about that. We're also very nervous about it. And we're also very conscious of not knowing the solution to the conflict in the Middle East. But I'll finish with the story, which I think is a good one. It shows how crazy things are in this country. We did... if you didn't know already, we did. I'll just very briefly. We did a story. We did a process with an ambassador. I won't say which. And the process went on for about a year. And at the end of it, what the ambassador said, in the kind of closing remarks, was he said, I came into this completely disagreeing with everything that you stand for, and now I completely disagree with everything that you stand for. But what I thought I disagreed with and what I actually disagreed with are two completely different worlds. And there's all sorts of stuff that I assumed about you that you don't really believe in. You've got other ideas. Publish it. Say, for example, that you're against burning down trees. And that you're against killing people and destroying property. Say it. To which the rabbis said to him, well, why don't you come out with a statement that you're against burning down trees? And he said, why do I need to do that? And they said, why do we? And it kind of went round and round and round. Until they genuinely got the sense that he was trying to help them be understood. And they produced this document. Now, the document got published. It's a great document. It got published. We weren't behind the publication. We don't like doing things that are public. We like working very quietly and behind the scenes. But the last line of the document had a little prayer for the Mashiach Tzidkenu, Yavovi Yigaleinu, whatever. And when the Bet Mikdash is built in the future, they wrote in the document, they quoted Yishayahu and Avi, that it has to be a Bet Mikdash, Beiti Beit Tfilah Yikare L'Kol HaAmim, that all the nations of the world will worship there. And they added in this thing, and the Bet Mikdash can only be built when all the peoples of the world unite and want it. So that goes out. A couple of weeks later, I get a phone call. This is where things get crazy. I get a phone call from a Satmar Chassid. Who's the Satmar Chassid? He's this guy who's always going off to Ramallah to meet with Abu Mazen because he's complaining about the Israeli government, whatever. And he said to me, listen, I was going there, I had a meeting with Abu Mazen, I had my own agenda. At the end of the meeting, Abu Mazen picks up this document. He's got it in Arabic, and it's signed by a whole bunch of rabbis from the settlements, that says that we don't want to destroy Al-Aqsa. What the hell is this? It's got your name on it, so I'm calling you. Can you explain? Abu Mazen is interested in knowing what it is. So, what came out of this wasn't a meeting with Abu Mazen. We decided that was probably not a very good idea for a whole range of reasons. We thought about it very carefully. But we asked Abu Mazen, indirectly, we asked him to select religious leaders from Ramallah who would be prepared to meet with rabbis from Yehuda Shomron to talk about what would the future peace in the Temple Mount Al-Aqsa look like from their shared religious perspective. Now, I don't think that's ever been done before. don't think that's ever been done before. It was a sustained process. They produced some really remarkable insights and results. They also developed quite a lot of empathy. It was very clear to all of them there's nothing you can do because, you know, there's too much other stuff going on that this can't turn into anything practical until there's a lot of other things that have been resolved first. But what this demonstrates is, first of all, that people who feel safe engaging in dialogue can expand the scope of who they're prepared to talk to and what they're prepared to talk about very, very significantly. And there are solutions to be found when people feel empathetically towards each other that you're never going to find when all you're doing is clashing with each other. So that's just a little taste of some of the things that we've been doing over the last couple of years. I'm pretty sure that's more than enough for you to take your time and to ask questions while I enjoy Elisheva's honey tea. Please, tell me your names as you ask.
Hey.
I'm Alec.
Hi, Alec. I'm Jessica. Thank you for sharing. This has been really illuminating. So I guess at Pardes we have, you know, like a lot of models of how to constructively disagree, and the first thing we usually have is like a shared text. And you said that you bring people together just first and foremost to discuss the concept of peace, and I'm wondering like how you start that discussion and give people language and like facilitate that.
With pleasure. Happy to answer it. We don't sit around tables, we don't have texts. We sit in a circle, in an intimate circle, where everyone can see everyone, we care a lot about all the energies and all that kind of stuff. There's a whole mystical, crazy side to this as well, which I love. But the in that specific issue of peace, so what we did in our what we call our classic groups, which was the first groups, we gave people. It went on for a year because every meeting was dedicated to a person. Right, it took quite a long time just to get people to sit together in the same room. But once we'd accomplished that, we dedicated a meeting to a person. And each person was given three questions. And they were given time ahead of time to prepare it. And we asked them to address three questions. They were given 45 minutes to speak. And in those 45 minutes, nobody was allowed to interrupt. No questions of clarification, nothing. Just listen. Be for that person. Listen. And then they asked questions, and the person who was presenting didn't get to answer. The whole point was to try and create an environment of listening. And the questions were, how do you understand peace as a concept? People draw on their own resources, particularly, these are influential rabbis, they're kind of good with texts, but also, other people bring a rich textual dimension. So some of them handed out texts, some of them just quoted them, some of them read them out with tears in their eyes. I mean, it gets very... The second question, which was, I think, the most powerful one, was to reflect on the experiences in your life in which your contact with peace has been either meaningful or painful for you. For a lot of these people, pain is associated with peace. A lot of blood has been spilled, a lot of injury, a lot of pain. And people need to be able to explain what's motivating them, because they've got stories that are very, very powerful and often much more powerful than the ideas. And the third question was, can you look at your ideal of peace, look at the reality as you see it, and tell us something that you want to do to try and bridge the gap between the two? And after 45 minutes of making a presentation of this sort, a lot of knowledge gets accumulated. People really get to know each other quite intimately. By the end of the year, they've heard some of the most moving and painful stories in each other's lives. When that was finished, that would be the kind of first hour, then Sharon would facilitate a kind of psychodramatic entry into one of the stories that they shared. That gives them the opportunity, it's not play acting, bless you, they've lived. It's not play acting, but it gives people the opportunity to become meaningful in each other's stories, and sometimes to remember things about the stories that they've forgotten as they canonized them in their own memories, and sometimes to change things about the stories, or to imagine other outcomes of the stories, or to speak to people who weren't there, who are significant. And this process really allowed people to go much, much more deeply into what peace means in their lives. And when they own it as a concept that they are in favor of because it's their version of it, they take on identities as peacemakers. And you know, we've seen quite a lot of examples of that, of how that happens. And they all, often people who are in the peace camp start to identify how they haven't always been peacemakers sometimes. And they deepen their sense of what it is to be a peacemaker. Because when you leave people out in your peacemaking, you're actually opening up a new conflict. And people started to own that, to pay attention to it. So that was it. It wasn't text study. We learned pretty quickly that text study doesn't work with these kinds of people. Yes, please. Anybody else?
One thing that I find really difficult is how do you bring to the table people in the first place?
No table. To the circle.
To the circle.
Very significant.
This is...
How do we do it technically, or how do we bring ourselves to do it emotionally? Well, I'm not quite sure if I understand what you're asking.
Because I feel that where the situation becomes complicated is because the people who should talk together the most are not willing to. Do you do any reach out work to try to get people to accept talk, or do you take any volunteers to do it?
No. That is a huge part of our work. I don't like using the word recruiting because it's got military connotations, but if you can come up with a better word, getting people to come. When we put together a group, we dedicate about 4 months to the preparation process. First of all, the people who agree to come, we meet with them several times. We go to their homes, wherever they are. We meet with them. We try to get to know them. We try to understand them. We choose them very carefully. Some people we have to work very hard to convince, and a lot of people we fail to convince. But what we've noticed is over the years it's getting easier. And one of the reasons why it's getting easier is because we keep a very low profile, right? I haven't told you the names of any of the participants in the last 40 minutes, because we don't make a name for ourselves on their backs. And nothing leaks from our processes, and as the years have gone on and people see that and begin to trust it, they're a little bit more willing to come along. But that's a huge part of our work, is how to win the trust of people and never to violate it, although we've made mistakes on that as well. But to win the trust of people and get them to come along is a huge part of this. Sometimes, I mean, I've got some crazy stories of journeys that I've made to try and, you know, or that we've made together to try and get people to come. Yes, please.
My name is Josh. I found kind of what you were saying about the rabbi's group meeting with the Palestinian religious leaders really interesting. I was thinking, have you guys done any work between, you know, Jews in Israel and the Palestinian citizens of Israel?
Yes, we have. We've got two projects that are addressing that. We're also doing some work we're doing an indirect crazy process. I don't know how it's going to work out, but we've started it, and it's reaching out to the Jordanian Muslim Brotherhood, who we recognise as being extremely important if you want to try and reach, you know, the opposition camps in Palestinian society.
Right.
We're also doing work with Syrians. So you know, we're gradually expanding the scope and the scale of the people that we are working with and meeting. Like when we finally get the guts, we'll try and work with Americans, but that's just too tense at the moment. That's too tense. When we finish with the Jordanian Muslim Brotherhood, we'll
think
about
I don't think that's
too much.
I know.
Maybe one day. The French are quite a challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rabbis don't want to meet with the French. They really don't want to meet with the French.
They don't want to meet with French?
With the French. It's quite an issue. There's a lot of anger against France.
The French are the most closed ones also, hence my question.
Yeah. That's what they say.
That's right.
I've had meetings with the French. We'll see.
We
just got back from Paris.
Are you talking about journalists or French Jews?
No, French officials, government officials. French
with
government
French
officials.
Rabbis or...
No, Mapiton. French government officials.
With rabbis from Israel, Israeli rabbis. Ah, not French rabbis.
No. Yes.
I'm still formulating this a little bit, but... Okay. I'm seeing, like, as we're learning more about this whole realm of
It's a whole little world, isn't
whatever
it?
Whatever you want to call it, that's enough of a controversy, but that there's a difference between getting people to talk and hear each other's stories and all of the dialogue elements and people actually changing their opinions about what is just, what policies need to be, what real on-the-ground changes need to happen, and different organizations have different goals regarding this, and a lot of the time the goal is really to just either get people in the same place, maybe not even talk about politics, or it's to get people in the same place, share their stories, but it's not to change opinions, it's really about listening and just getting a better sense. So I'm wondering, but I really think that that change of opinions needs to happen if we're ever going to reach justice, is like people need to, like how does policy change if people don't eventually take action? But my question is, like, do you see people changing their mind about policies or about what justice looks like based on these interactions? And is that any part of your goal?
So that's a brilliant phrased question. It's a really important question. Our objective, we as an organization do not have any political stance that we advocate at all. Our basic assumption, Daniel said something before that is very, very important, which is that civil society has a really, really significant role, and civil society needs to be expanded very significantly. I'd love to see an international investment in civil society, which is conscious of the need to build bridges between people and not to entrench differences. Civil society is all the kinds of organizations that we're talking about. Okay? Now, civil society divides up into two types, or there are many types, but for the purposes of the reduction that I'm giving you now, civil society can be divided into organizations that have their own sense of justice, have their own sense of what peace needs to look like, and what they do is they try to consolidate support for their vision of peace, okay, and for their vision of justice. Your justice question brings me back to, is it just to divide up a piece of cloth? Well, obviously, it could be, but not if somebody else thinks a piece of cloth is a baby. I mean, it's complicated. So the other objective in civil society, and this is where, you know, Daniel and I very much belong to the same camp, the same worldview, is that the purpose of civil society is not to entrench differences by supporting one or other particular political point of view, which leaves us in a situation of deadlock that we've been in for 30 years and more. But to try and change the mode of interaction between people who are never going to agree with each other. And it's naive to think that you're going to convince somebody of the type that we're dealing with on both sides of this, by the way. The entrenchment is equally deep on both sides of this. And it's naive to think that you're going to convince them that they're right, or to convince them that they're right, and we'll all get on board for the one agenda, and let's go ahead and we'll make peace. It doesn't work like that. People are deeper than that, and their convictions are not so easily changed. However, you can change the relationship between people. And you can create peace in a situation in which the differences of opinion, to use a metaphor that Rav Kook uses, function like different limbs in a single body. The different limbs in the single body are very different from each other, and they mustn't become alike. Because if your heart and your pancreas start doing the same thing, you're dead. But if they are themselves in the fullest sense, then there's a bigger balance, there's a bigger body that lives when they are themselves in the fullest sense. There's a principle in Kabbalah, Leit Atal Panui Mine, which basically means that everything is an expression of God's presence. So everything that is, has a purpose. It needs to be dignified. And the question is, can you hear? This is Sharon, what I'm saying now. You've got to hear two things. Number one, can you hear?
It's Sharon, not...
What? No, the next line is Sharon. What?
Go on.
Not Ariel Sharon.
Correct.
Sharon...
Yes.
Can you hear what people are protecting? Can you figure out when somebody's putting up a wall, what it is that they're protecting? And when you can understand what they're protecting, can you find a way of ensuring them that it's safe and allow them to embrace a deeper identity in which they... People people really do want to live in peace. I think it's very deep. It's very profound. And they're prepared to fight, just even though they live in peace. They're prepared to fight to protect things that are very, very sacred to them. But can you get them to go deeper? And when they do, you make a lot of space. And you make a lot of space for people to react differently to each other, to relate differently to each other, and even to do things together in disagreement. It's a very Jewish idea. But doing things together in disagreement is the path that I'm interested in promoting, that we are interested in promoting. I don't think that your version of justice or somebody else's version of justice or your version of peace or somebody else's version of peace is going to decide it for everybody. The question is, can you create a circle that doesn't leave anybody out on all sides? And that's really tough. That's really tough.
So I want to thank you so much for that wisdom.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
We could have sat here for several more hours and go deeper and deeper. I think it was a great, great example of what we've been talking about, of machlok at the Shem Shamayim, of a disagreement with the sake of that, creating structures that destructive disagreements can actually become constructive and to fulfill what our understanding, the Jewish concept of peace, of shalom, is the machloket, is holding up, you know, contradictory values and fears and stories and being able to embrace that and be able to then create societies that can live together. So, toda rabba.
Besimcha.
Besimcha.
Thank you.
To be continued.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.